This is Jerry Pippin, and we're broadcasting from the UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada. And, of course, we've done many shows on Roswell, and we know about back engineering. And so this is logical. You stop and think about it.
And if the back engineering, in fact, occurred, then the benefits would be going to
what? The corporations.
To the corporation. Is exactly. Who would have control over the technology?
Well, you got a good point. The government and the corporations.
Yeah.
And they work hand in hand these days. In fact, we've had more than one person on this show over the years saying that they've come up with a way to save money on certain things, and the think tank or the engineering company or whoever was had a big fat government contract, and they basically say, well, we can't do that. We're making too much money.
That's right. That's exactly why if they came up with a free energy machine, they would obviously suppress that, because that would destroy their petrochemical empire.
Seems to be a lot of buzz on free energy machines these days. Do you think this is coming back to the forefront?
Yes, I think so. In fact, I know that there are some very, very credible scientists, not only in the United States but around the world, who are working very hard on alternative energy sources and really basically swimming upstream, because not only do the large corporations shun that, but then they also try to stifle it, and if they do get something, they lock it away. Plus, there's been a concerted effort since the early 50s to denigrate and play down and ridicule anybody who wants to talk about free energy or anti-gravity or whatever, but that wasn't always the case. In the 40s, 30s, 40s, and in the very early 50s, there were magazine articles, newspaper articles about that very thing. Lawrence D. Bell, L.D. Bell,
right.
Was actually quoted as saying the next generation of aircraft will operate anti-gravity. And then
we're talking about the Bell helicopter guy.
Yeah, yeah. And John Lear, his dad, Bill Lear, inventor of the Learjet, he also was talking about anti-gravity craft. And then all of a sudden this curtain came down, and it's like, that doesn't exist. And then starting with the large corporations who give the grants to the universities, who fund the physics departments and the engineering departments, they were all told, oh, well, that's nonsense. That's just science fiction. It doesn't work. You guys go over here and keep working on aerospace and ramjet engines and rockets and the stuff that we know about.
We're broadcasting from the UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada, and Jim Mars is with us. And we are doing a series on 9/11, and that's one reason we're bouncing around on this show, Jim, to give us a chance to talk about all these other things, because our 9/11 series is going to be very, very targeted. And you've really, as you say, jumped on this story the next day.
Yeah.
And basically,
let me tell you the progress, what happened.
Okay,
here.
Okay.
The next day I'm on to, before the end of 2001, I'm getting my major publisher in New York City, okay? And they dragged their feet, and they said, I don't know, emotions are very high, you know, we don't know if we want to get into this. So it dragged along into the spring of 2002. And if you'll remember, at that time, you had the whistleblowers within the FBI and within the CIA, Kathleen Riley.
Yes.
And, the agents in Arizona that were talking about, hey, we tried to tell them these guys were training on aircraft and that they were perfectly capable of flying into buildings, you know. And so all of a sudden that came up, and all of a sudden the idea that maybe there was something else going on behind the scenes wasn't quite so dissettling. And so the publisher in New York said, okay, we're going to go. And so I got a contract. And so I worked feverishly, and by the early fall of 2002, I had a book to put together called The War on Freedom. And it not only dealt with 9/11, but with the Patriot Act, with Homeland Security, showing very, very, with very well sourced, how that they were at the very least using 9/11 to curtail our liberties and to completely change the complexion of American society. Okay, it passed the legal vetting. which means the lawyers looked at it and they had lots of questions, but I had a source, you know, here it is.
Right, right.
And you have to understand, that doesn't mean that what I'm saying is 100% correct. It's simply that it is coming from somebody. It's been published. It's been somewhere. And somebody said this, and I'm reporting on that. I'm
right.
a reporter.
Right.
And so it passed the legal vetting. And the very next day, a vice president who admitted she had not even read it said, we have to cancel this book. And the only reason they gave is they said they didn't want to upset the families of 9/11 victims, which is a totally specious argument because we all know it's been the families of 9/11 that have pressed and pressed and pressed trying to get an investigation and trying to find out what happened to their loved ones.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, they gave you an advance and they said keep it.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and they had paid me the rest of it.
Oh, did
yeah,
they?
Yeah, they say, here, take all this money and I just go away.
Yeah.
So I took their money and I self-published it and as The War on Freedom. It got very limited circulation. And then about a year later, a West Coast publisher bought the rights to it. But he said, I don't have the money to publish this whole book. He said, so I'm only going to publish the section on 9/11. Well, that came out in a very, very nice, well-presented little book called Inside Job. And it got lots of good reviews and got spread a pretty good distribution. But still, it had not reached that many people, and it did not put it all in the context. So another year passed, and here last year in 2006, the rights to Inside Job were sold to another New York publisher. And during the negotiations, I said, well, you know, this is only a third of what I wrote. I said, I got two-thirds back over here. And they said, oh, well, let us see it. And so they said, wow, we want this too. So now the whole thing, back together, expanded and updated from the 2002 edition, is finally available to the public under the title The Terror Conspiracy.
And we have a link where you can get The Terror Conspiracy, and a lot of people have read it, and it's a thick book. You did a lot of research.
Yeah, it's almost 500 pages, but the thing that I think I want to point out is it like 31 or 32 pages are nothing but sources, source notes. You know, here's where this came from. Check it out for yourself. Because I would tell your listening audience, just like I tell my classes at the university, I'm not asking for your belief. Don't believe me. Don't trust me. Okay? And certainly don't trust the corporate control media. Start thinking for yourselves, read the information that's available, and start making up your own mind. And so here's 32 pages of sources. You can go back and backtrack and double check me. And what I'm saying is true or not. Go find out for yourself.
We're talking with Jim Mars. We'll be right back. We're going to take a break. It seems to me that the 9/11 scenario has been tried before. In fact, the Patriot Act, had that tack been used before? Jim mentioned the act back when Harry Truman had to sign it in 1947. Seems to me there's similar circumstances. We might flush that out when we come back. This is Jerry Pippin.
This is Ed Asner. When Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held a serious bipartisan investigation that resulted in articles of impeachment. Strong evidence suggests that George Bush and Dick Cheney launched an illegal war and lied to Congress, spied on Americans without court approval, leaked classified information, produced phony news reports, imprisoned without charge, and tortured, targeted civilians, and used illegal weapons. Ask your Congress member to co-sponsor House Resolution 635 for an investigation.
Sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
This is Jerry Pippin. I want to encourage you to come to our website often. We have a broadcast series with Jim Mars coming up soon on 9/11. In which he's our consultant, and we're going to focus on each of these issues we just glossed over in a couple of sentences. But the overriding thing, Jim Mars, to me, and a lot of people ask me this, and they say one of two things. They say, I just can't believe the American government would do that to its own people. Or, has that ever happened before?
And the answer, unfortunately, is very definitely yes. What is now becoming very clear to historians and researchers who have really been paying attention and gathering all the information is that Pearl Harbor was not the sneak attack that we were told it was, that Roosevelt, his chief of staff, George Marshall, handful of others in Washington knew that Pearl Harbor was going to be attacked. They knew when, and they allowed it to happen because you have to understand, Roosevelt got elected to an unprecedented fourth term in office. They changed the law right after that on the pledge that he would keep us out of war. And yet by mid-1941, I think it was obvious that we probably were going to end up getting in the war. I think he knew that. I think he, so he had a dilemma. If he had simply said, we have to go to war, there would have been a considerable division in this country. The polls were showing 80-90% of the public said, we don't want to be involved in this. And so they needed an event, a provocation, to get a united and angered American public into the war. So when they learned that Pearl Harbor was going to be attacked, Japanese decoding machines were sent to every base in the Pacific except Pearl Harbor. The aircraft carriers that they needed to fight a Pacific war were suddenly out of Pearl Harbor. And on Sunday, of course, December the 7th, Pearl Harbor was attacked. 3,000 Americans were killed. The next day, we declared war, and we went into World War II. So, yes, it can happen. In fact, here's a little piece of irony. The next day, Congress created a committee to investigate and find out what had happened at Pearl Harbor. And they decided on these scapegoats, Admiral Kimmel and General Short, and said they were just derelict in duty. They were just, a failure of intelligence. And the same things we hear following 9/11. You know, it was just a screw-up. And Admiral Kimmel and General Short fought for years against this verdict. And then after they passed away, their families continued the fight. In the summer of 2001, it was getting very close to the point to where the Bush White House was going to issue a public apology and announce that, yes, that's true, that they really had not been derelict in their duty and that there were other things involved in Pearl Harbor. But then 9/11 came and the decision was made that they would not do this and not make this public because, in the words of one Washington reporter, it might draw attention and might cause people to compare the complicity of the government in Pearl Harbor with 9/11. Isn't that ironic? And then we also know that now about Operation Northwoods.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Okay. In 1961, of course, there was the failed Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, which originally we told the world we had nothing to do with. Adlai Stevenson got up in the United Nations.
At the UN.
And he said, no, this is not us. We're not doing this. But that story quickly broke down. And, of course, it turned out that we really were. We had armed, trained, backed, supported the Cuban brigade. And, of course, it met disaster at the Bay of Pigs. They were taken into captivity. And this is an interesting point here. President Kennedy, and I can clearly remember this, went on national television, and he said, this happened on my watch, and I will take full responsibility, and basically offered an apology. I'm sorry this happened, and I'll take the responsibility. He did not have to do that, because what is clear from the record is that he was not even aware of the Bay of Pigs invasion until after his election. And he was finally briefed in early December of 1960 and told, by the way, we've got this invasion plan going on for Cuba. And who was responsible then? The White House political action officer of Eisenhower, Richard M. Nixon.
Yeah. Oh, no, Nixon himself.
Yeah, Nixon had authorized the Bay of Pigs invasion. So,
I didn't know that.
Oh, he took full credit for it in his book, My Three Crises. And so Kennedy legitimately could have said, hey, I'm sorry, but this wasn't my deal. You know, Nixon did this, but he didn't. He sucked it up. He was a man. He said, this happened on my watch. I'll take responsibility. Have we heard anything even remotely like that from President Bush about 9/11?
No. Not at all.
No apologies. No I'm sorries. No nothing. Okay? So in the wake of that, Kennedy, needless to say, was upset about the failure of the Bay of Pigs. So he took the secret war against Castro and took it away from the CIA and turned it over to the Pentagon. Now, the Pentagon planners went to work, and they came up with Operation Northwoods. And essentially, this was a plan to target Americans for assassination, hijack airplanes, sink ships on the high sea, set off bombs in American cities, particularly Miami and Atlanta and New Orleans, and blame it all on Castro. Okay, this is what is known as a false flag operation. Okay, now you see one flag waving and you say they did it, but they didn't really do it.
Right.
So now what's really amazing about this, and here is another great piece of irony, is that, and never forget this, the Joint Chiefs of Staff approved Operation Northwoods. They thought that was a good plan, okay? Because this way we'll enrage the American people. They will demand that we invade Cuba. We'll have full support, and we'll get to carry out our military mission. Kennedy was the one who said, wait a minute, we don't play that way. And if we play that way, then we're no better than the people we call our enemies. And he ordered all copies of Northwoods destroyed. But typical government bureaucracy, at least one set, did not get destroyed. It lay around in a government file for years and years and years until the mid-90s, when the Assassination Records Review Board, which was created by Congress in the wake of the Oliver Stone movie JFK and tasked to look into government files for anything that might have to do with Kennedy or those years or the assassination. And what do? They find Operation Northwoods. They placed it in the National Archives. And so now it became public. We know what their plans were. And I just find it great irony that it was Kennedy's assassination and the subsequent investigation of the Assassination Records Review Board that revealed to us how our own military would attack their own citizens in a false flag operation to further their own agendas.
You know, it seems that they've been using the same playbook all along, just changing the names of the players.
Right.
And when we've only got about 5 minutes left here on this show, and we've been talking about a lot of general things. You think the same people behind the Kennedy assassination were behind 9/11? I mean, not specifically, but more or less the same groups?
The same groups, the same power bases, yes. And let me wrap up with this. We've all heard Condoleezza Rice and even President Bush basically say, well, how could we have ever thought that they would have hijacked airplanes and flown them into buildings, right? We've all heard that.
Right.
But let me point out that in March of 2001, 6 months before 9/11, on a TV program written by Chris Carter, the guy that wrote the X-Files, there was a program aired that had a scenario of rogue government agents within the government piggybacking on war game exercisings, using drone airplanes. We're going to crash them into the World Trade Center towers to generate a war on terrorism so that they could generate more profits for the military-industrial complex. And he wrote this 6 months. So if a TV writer can envision this 6 months before 9/11, how can Rice and Bush say, who would have ever thought that? Surely they've got more intelligence and more consultation than a TV writer.
We urge our listeners to be checking our website for our 9/11 series, because Jim Mars laid out pretty much here in 4 or 5 paragraphs what we're going to go in detail and get the people talking who were involved. It's going to be a long, you know, one of the things, and this happens when, especially you write books now, but when you're a reporter, you write a story, Jim, sometimes you get reactions from people and leads that you never thought you'd get.
Absolutely, yeah. When you put the story out there and somebody realizes that you know the story, or at least you're getting close to it,
yeah,
then they come out of the woodwork.
Yeah,
they
either
say, well, let me tell you.
Yeah,
just this past weekend, I had a retired air traffic controller who was working in 2001. And he gave me some really astounding information about how they were able to subvert our normal hijack emergency procedures.
Well, we'll have to stay tuned for that. We'll get into more of that. This whole thing is just unraveling, isn't it? Doesn't it appear to you?
I think so. In fact, what I find most astounding and most hopeful is that 6 years after the Kennedy assassination, and I was there, and I was trying to tell people there's something stinks about this, and I was the nut and the conspiracy theorist. And in fact, if you'll remember, Jerry, it was not even considered polite to talk about that in public, you know. And here we are only 6 years out from 9/11, and national polls are showing that 50-60% of the population is not buying the official conspiracy theory of the 19 suicidal hijackers.
Just think how smart the American public would be if the media were doing their job.
If the media would do their job, I think all this could be cleared up, because I have unlimited faith and confidence in the goodwill, the good intentions, and the honesty of the average American. The problem is if you're being fed incomplete or erroneous information, I don't care how smart you are, you can't make a correct decision about anything.
Jim Mars, it's a pleasure having you on, and I look forward to working with you very closely on this, and we will be revealing more as we go along about all of these people, just like the man that came forward on how they would... Before we go on that air traffic control question, there was obviously something going on, and that was an exercise, right? So there were false blips. So people, we say, how could they not know those hijacked planes? Well, they didn't know what planes were what.
Well, they had also made a seemingly small change to the procedures prior to the Bush administration. If an air traffic controller wanted to declare a hijack emergency, he could on his own authority. And then immediately contact NORAD and local commanders if they felt this was serious, could launch their own planes. You may recall in 1999 when the golfer Payne Stewart's plane went off course.
They tracked that.
Yeah, 14 minutes, there's jets all around his plane, okay? But under the Bush administration, they began to change the procedures. The air traffic controllers could not take on the authority to declare emergency. They had to contact supervisors. Supervisor had to contact somebody else. And then they couldn't contact NORAD and get a response out of them without going through the Secretary of Defense's office. In other words, you got to get hold of Rumsfeld before you can send off jet fighters. And, of course, on the morning of 9/11, there's been two or three conflicting stories on exactly where Rumsfeld was and exactly when. So this is what this air traffic controller called the slow track. Okay, so on the morning of 9/11, they had to go through the slow track. And what was really interesting is the next day they scrapped the slow track.
Well,
and they went back to the way they'd been doing
things. It served its usefulness.
That's right. So in other words, they instituted this, pulled off the attack, and then went back to normal reaction procedures.
You've just had a preview of what we'll be doing with lots of other people talking and lots of actualities and lots of in-depth stories coming up. Jim Mars, it's always a pleasure. We'll be talking to you again soon. Thanks for coming by. Well, and you love these UFO congresses, don't you?
Oh, listen, this is a bunch of good folks. You get a wide range of people, and the main thing I love about them is that they're pretty much open to, you know, they'll listen to anything, you know.
And you went over well yesterday.
Well, and, you know, I'm always telling people that your mind is like a parachute. It works better when it's open.
With that, we'll close. This has been a show from the UFO Congress. Roberta Scott's our on-location producer. Our tape editor was Jane Swartley. Until next time, cheers.
The doors are finally open at ShopJerryPippin.com. Explore our new iShop. It's open and growing. You can use any major credit card or your checking account with our PayPal connection. Our first edition t-shirt selections features three different Jerry Pippin UFO files designs. In addition, we will be adding collector t-shirts from select UFO conferences, as well as several novelty items. Check us out at ShopJerryPippin.com.